Emotionally, I've been having some trouble finding peace this week. Nothing new on the baby front. It looks like a tiny fish right now, apparently. Really a miracle if you think about it. Anyway, details of my emotions this week. This is just my personal therapy session, isn't it? And my second interview with Rachel Hope, my dear friend and fairy godmother of parenting partnerships. It's my unconventional life. Continuing. I went to the woods because I wanted to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. My name is Nigel McGuinness, and this is My Unconventional Life. It's a podcast, it's a journal, and in a way, it is kind of a personal ad. But most of all, it's about navigating the treacherous waters of love, sex, and relationships in 2017. Sponsored by absolutely no one. Every week, I detail my own journey and discuss my own untraditional views and aspirations in that world. Whatever the topic, whoever the guest, it all comes back to one question. How do we best find and express love in 2017? Once again, it's been a week of swirling emotions. There's value, I think, in realizing the transient nature of these emotions during this time period and sitting with them. And I think with time, you'll start to see the common themes and realize what is more core and genuine. I have felt sick with anxiety at points this week, conflicted about being monogamous while feeling non-monogamous, looking at Eri and feeling such love and knowing that our child is growing inside her. It's certainly to be expected that our emotions would fluctuate during this time too. Eri started to have cravings, feeling depressed for no reason some days and then elated the next. And I was a little concerned when she felt depressed for the first few days after finding out she was pregnant, but I tried not to judge it or ask her to think about it and accept it's probably just hormones. For my part, over the last couple of months, I'm not sure I've ever experienced such fluctuation with such strong emotions. Being in love or infatuation, or whatever you call this stage of a sexual relationship, it's hard on your psyche. I watched a play this week called Monopoly about two monogamous couples who interact with a polyamorous triad and the hijinks and emotions that ensue. And it had some really great moments and insights and, of course, gave me a lot to think about. And for one, I still have way too many hang-ups about sex and take it way too seriously. It should be freeing and natural. Also, if and when Eri and I open up, it has to be because we both want to. It can't be her just going along with it, which presents a big problem, of course, but we'll deal with it if and when it happens. See, I was already catastrophizing again. We have a lot of other stuff on our plates first anyway. As always, I need to meditate more and be truly present. But at the same time, I shouldn't ignore this burgeoning anxiety in my chest. Like most things, though, the answer is to be found inside me. I could be imagining it, but I have seemed to feel that Eri is a little less in love with me. After I told her that I'd be monogamous while we're having the kid to help build our core relationship. And it's occurred to me since then that subconsciously, perhaps, Eri lost respect for me when I told her this. And consciously, it alleviated a lot of her fears, but in David Dada's Way of the Superior Man, that I constantly reference, I know, he talks about how women will sometimes subconsciously try to change the man they love. And that it's really a test. Consciously, they think they do want the man to change, but subconsciously, they're really testing the man's resolve in the face of adversity. Because they want a man who is strong and sticks to the values that he feels strongly about. She wants someone she can depend on, to protect her, who can go into the world and not be so easily changed by the emotional pressures of others. And when I change so quickly, hearing about her feeling jealous and stressed, perhaps subconsciously it gave her cause for concern. I mean, look, we've all been guilty of letting jealousy influence our decisions. And I think that's part of my conflict too, because I always took pride that I got to a stage when I didn't. There is the intellectual side of the argument too. After reading more of The Anatomy of Love by Helen Fisher that Venus lent me, I truly do believe that lifelong monogamy is just not natural. It's unfeasible, and it's as much so for women as it is for men. Certainly to live that way in a genuinely fulfilling way. And the point is, there's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't have to be. If it's not truly our nature, surely we'd be happier if we did away with it. Now, monogamy is natural, the desire to be with just one person, because we see it all across human history. But the idea that it should last for the rest of our lives, that's not. And it's our belief or hope that it will that makes us suffer. Or more likely, perhaps, the fact that the desire to be with one person rarely fades equally within a monogamous relationship. It can last years or sometimes weeks. I have good days and bad days with this conflict. And part of it, of course, is tied to how every one of my monogamous relationships ended so badly to where they no longer wanted to have me in their life in any way, shape, or form. And I was left with deep, painful scars. And that was why I really wanted to avoid a sexually monogamous relationship, certainly with the person I was having kids with. I mean, a lot of the anxiety comes from feeling genuinely that I'm risking the future happiness of my kids. So we can't sort this out once they're born. We need to have peace with it now. And that might just be something I need to do on my own, through meditation and introspection, or something we can do together, with or without counseling. Now, I'm still cognizant of my realization last week. There is value in keeping some thoughts to yourself. But I'm also aware that one of the very best things about Eri and my relationship was how we were able to be so open with each other without the fear of being judged. And I don't like the idea of that changing. I am 100% committed to Eri and our children. So anything less than absolute honesty with her, it's not enough. Love is not easy sometimes. Certainly when it comes in strong and commandeers your body and your mind. But it is the core of our human condition. And it provides us with such joy and exhilaration. The love that I feel for Eri is profound. The love that I feel for all girls is profound too. And the love that I feel for everyone and the world in general is profound too. And I think if there is something to take from this, is that I just need to find a way to be able to express all the love I feel within me in the most productive, positive way. Whew. Well, the interview this week is the second one with Rachel Hope. I met Rachel originally off a parenting partnership website, and for whatever reason, we never figured out the details to move forward in that direction, but instead, she has become one of my dearest, closest confidants in the world. I love her dearly. She is kind, intelligent, beautiful, just an incredible human being that I feel blessed to have in my life and care about me. In the time since our first interview, so much has changed that it's almost mind-boggling. But through it all, she has continued to be an amazing mum and fantastic advocate for what she believes in. Her strength is truly inspiring. Anyway, here she is. So we are ready for the second exciting installment of an interview with Rachel Hope. Hello, my dear. How are you?
Well, I'm very good because I'm alive. I'm a little injured laying here in my bed.
Yeah, you are currently on your side protecting your neck, which what's wrong with it exactly?
Well, I was hit by a truck when I was a kid, so I had two very damaged pieces, part of my spine, and I've been just kind of trailing along. In 2012, they invented the part that I needed. So like a good cyborg, I got a new full hinge joint that holds C5, C6 together in my spine. I may have to have a second one that was recommended to me in 2014. But I've kept it at bay. This might be the end of my rope on that one. Hey, bit, I'm alive, and I'm talking, and I'm walking when I need to.
Right. Now, it's been, how long has it been since we did our first interview? I mean, I've been doing this for a year and a half now, I think.
I think I was one of your first.
You had to be one of the first and one of the longer ones as well.
And I think I was just visiting from Europe at the time.
Maybe, right. So your life's changed quite dramatically.
Yeah, but we didn't really get into that much of my life, did we? Last time?
For the life of me, I don't remember.
I haven't boned up on it, so.
Yeah, right.
Could end up being very, very different. We could just start over. Let's just start.
Well, you're still in a parenting partnership relationship.
I sure am.
With your parenting partner, and you have a wonderful tomboy-like, is she 7 or 8 now?
She's 8. She'll be 9 in December.
Wow.
And I still am, you know, having an adult child is another phase of parenting. We don't do much hands-on interference or interaction with what our son chooses, but I have a parenting partnership with a 26-year-old son as well.
Right.
So, he's doing fantastically, and I just spent a lot of time with his dad in Hawaii.
Oh, okay.
We're still very, 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 very connected. We text all the time, almost right. Every day. He's one of my best friends.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had those two parenting partnerships. Both are going well, although not perfectly. What I've realized is there's a pattern in my life. I've chosen two older, fuddy-duddy, former chef, weirdo, socially awkward men to be the fathers of my children. And now I end up sort of looking at my life as doing some sort of elder care on top of being a parenting partner, which is not your typical parenting partnership. I mean, that's usually two young people getting it together, starting their life out, making a, like you and Ari, making a choice as young, ready, but older and wise enough to make these decisions.
But did
imagine if you were 65. It's a different reality. So yeah, I have a different kind of a non-typical situation going on.
Yeah, but did that ever occur to, I mean, it had to sort of occur to you when you sort of realized how old he was in the first place, right?
Desperate women with the baby hots can sometimes blow past the fine print. I thought I was making a really good choice of people who were stable, solid, less likely to go off the rails. I'd seen a lot of people lose their mind around 40. So, and were untested by real heavy circumstances. What also impressed me and helped me to overcome whatever normal apprehensions people would have with having an older parenting partner were, you know, offset by very experienced people who had been the same for decades, verifiably, were probably not going to do anything really weird, probably have no mental health issues or any untreated addiction issues or whatever. I wanted reliable, and I got old. Reliable. They're old, and I'm actually looking after them too. I'm not sure I would recommend it.
So that really is. That's one of the things that if you were to write a second edition or of your book.
Oh, that's going to be in it.
Yeah.
Buyers beware. Good, solid, verifiable equipment also starts to fall apart. And is it bad? I don't know. Like Paul is probably a lot more patient and around the house and slow down and actually has the presence of mind to listen to outlandish stories that go on for 15 minutes. Whereas if he were hustling and running around with a bustling career and relationships or something like that, he'd probably be out the door, you know? So it's all a trade-off, but as a match with me, it's a little tough. He's very dominant in the house because he's used to running things. He runs like a sort of, I'm a corporate CEO type in the house energy. And I always wanted to be sort of more of the homemaker, central child care provider. And I've gotten muscled out on both of them.
Well, and the reality is, though, you never really had any discussion and or agreements about having this current version of the relationship.
Exactly. Right. This was never what the agreement was, which is another thing I'll put in my second book, which is, what are you going to do if everything in your entire agreement has to be renegotiated? Because the basis of the entire agreement got upturned.
Yeah.
So now we're, instead of him being this go-getter businessman who has a hand, who wanted to be hands-off on parenting and financially providing the means for me to do a pretty good stay-home mom run mm-hmm. for two kids, which is hard to do, to replace my income as the primary earner in my family for 25 years. It took somebody with some cash.
Yeah.
It wasn't going to be hurt substantially by replacing my income while I raised a couple kids for him. So that was the plan. And then he didn't do that. Could he have? He says he couldn't have. He says he lost all his money in the crash and blah, 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 blah. I've come to think that it's probably a little more complicated than that. Like he's very, very uncomfortable because he's used to having so much cash and he's gotten like miserly and wants to keep it for himself because he's desperate to feel comfortable because he's older and he has heart condition and he's scared. And he also has told me, you can handle it. Which is kind of true, but not fair. So now I've been more the 75% financial earner and also the parenting person and also.
Yeah.
So shit out of luck there, dear.
Right.
But I'm glad I have her.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know, these things happen in traditional relationships as well.
Exactly.
It's the nature of human beings, perhaps. So I don't know if there isn't a universal, unifying theme of the most important things to look for in a parenting partner, be it a traditional relationship or a parenting partnership.
I know what there is.
Yeah?
Yeah. A pretty decent, solid, verifiable track record of making and keeping agreements. I think we touched on this before. Cannot be underestimated.
Right.
I think it's a red flag right out the gate if somebody has a real problem following through on what you have allowed them to count on you for.
Right.
They're going to do that to their kid.
Yeah.
Your kid. Big red flag.
Right.
I think somebody who doesn't value their word and the effect that their promises have on other people have a certain level of cavalier that is going to be hard to work with.
Yeah.
They could get over it, but I prefer them get over it by some other big lesson in work or health or relationships, but not with a kid.
Right, absolutely. So right. Honoring obligations is super important.
That's the thing that I freaking pisses me off more than anything. It's super, super simple. Just make promises that you will keep. You know, otherwise, you're a big fucking time thief and you're, you know, working your infantile shit out on some kid's blueprint.
Right.
So stop that shit. That's not conscious parenting. I don't care what people really do. If they decide to parent alone, if they decide to parent a parenting partnership, if they decide to parent in a nuclear family or a tribe, good for them. Just do it conscientiousness. Don't play some games like, you know, bait and shift. I'm going to promise this and not do it. Really, kids are extremely sensitive to that.
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody else.
Right. Know? But it's interesting because, you know, you had quite a traumatic, troubled childhood, you know, to put a fine point on
it. It was just like, it's a complete miracle I'm slaying here today.
Right. And that's had a big effect.
Everything happened to me.
On your worldview, of course. How you raised your children, wanting to avoid a lot of the pitfalls that you had to
experience. Right, but I wasn't a helicopter parent.
Right.
I wasn't drinking the Kool-Aid, like somehow if I just hyper-vigilantly micromanage my child, that's going to protect them from every real and imagined boogeyman. I've focused very hard on preparing my children to be as awake, conscientious, well-informed, competent people. Case in point, this morning, because I'm laid up in bed and Grace was hungry and her dad, she's like, I ate everything in this house because the Nazi vegetarian is in charge. she can't get her steak, you know? So I said, honey, why don't you just go down to the cafe and get yourself a bagel and cream cheese? You know, like take charge. I wanted her to feel like, yeah, she can do that. And it's a few blocks, and she hasn't really gone out on her own like that, but she had her phone, her little fanny pack, and her own cash, and I'm like, you know, she can do this. So I encouraged her.
Yeah.
And so through the morning, all these good conversations came about because she talked to the homeless guy I told her not to talk to. And I'm not saying he's a bad person. We don't know, but he's clearly mentally ill, and we don't know what's in his head could not be the reality the rest of us see.
Correct.
So I said, honey, why did you do that? She goes, I felt sorry for him. I said, okay, I love that about you. Well, let's stay in your gut, stay inside your feelings about you, number one. and to make decisions based on your assessment of the situation. She says, well, I started feeling uncomfortable and I called my dad to come get me. And I said, good. That's the most important thing, because the truth of the matter is 90% of the time somebody does something shitty to a kid, it's in the trusted family, friends, neighbors.
Right.
That's a fact. It's not the homeless guy who's got schizophrenia on our street.
Yeah.
And a second to that, if somebody's trolling for, you know, kids, which is rare, they're going to be, oh, some guy dressed like someone's dad with a car seat in the back of his car driving a nice sedan and looking very daddy-like and saying all the right things to lure a kid.
Yeah.
He said, this homeless guy might save you from some dude like that. You can't tell.
You're right.
So I taught my kids to really tune in with their own gut. Stay inside themselves. Don't be seduced by society's pressure for them to be nice and be congenial, be pleasant. Especially girls. Especially yeah. good-looking girls.
Right.
That you should be quiet and pleasing and nice. So I guess a really empowered woman. Mm. A empowered young woman who believes that her instincts, what she sees, what she feels, and what she knows, and how she expresses herself is valuable, and that she does not need to comply with expectations of being cute little Carol.
Yeah.
And override that, which is what a lot of kids do and get themselves into trouble, and right. they get groomed.
Yeah, absolutely right. right. Yeah.
So, kid protection.
I talked to Eri about a similar sort of thing in terms of trying to convey that to our kids, you know, if and when we have kids now.
I did a theatrical presentation for today.
Oh, really?
Because I really needed to get... I have to compete with the freaking, you know, internet and, yeah. and bleaky screens. So I have to up my game.
Right.
And I did this entire, like, one-woman show for her. And I captivated her attention, concluding my theatrical presentation to Grace. Mm. To carry herself very confidently, like she has someplace to go, and she's not a needy person who's a needy child that's looking for attention. And those are that in the criminal mind, it's targeting, you know, easy pickings, easy targets that are on the fringe. And those are kids that are not well protected. They don't have a strong sense of self and a sense of belonging.
Yeah.
They rarely have problems because predators just go too much work. So I did a very funny theatrical presentation asking her to walk around thinking, I am totally protected and loved and valued and wanted. Everybody knows where I am, and I am powerful and strong. And if anybody ever did anything to me, to be thinking things like, oh, you better not mess with me. My mom will kill you. You know, run for your life. Like, she should be afraid for others. You know, that kind of feeling of confidence. You
yeah.
know? Now, not overconfidence where she go into situations where her instincts will tell her not to. But to walk down the street just feeling wanted and secure and known and seen, and not a needy little kid walking around like, oh, I need a little attention. And I'm not saying that's bad or wrong, because if that's true for a kid, then they need to get that attention. It's not, they're not their fault for right. a predator looking at them. But I'm just saying that blood in the water, you know what I mean? So all the more reason to cover our kids in enormous love. Not just value them, but to know them, to see them, to hear them. We have secret time every night. Grace tells me pretty much the contents of her psyche. Oh, I know yeah. exactly what my kid's thinking. Huh. I know what's on her mind. I know what she cries about. I know what she worries about.
Yeah.
That's the greatest insulation I can give
yeah.
her to ever having anything like that happen.
How do you cultivate that? Because a lot of kids just don't want to talk about what there's going on in their life, certainly with their parents.
Well, if their parents are invested in projecting a facade and denial about what's going on in their own lives, that kid's going to mimic that.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to tell you anything if you're invested in putting on a facade. But if you're, like, delivering it straight, I'm going to try not to give her inappropriate, premature adult content, for instance.
Yeah.
But when she asks me, straight up, I tell her.
Hmm.
Whatever she's got on her mind, I encourage her. I said, honey, you're on the internet. You're in a big world with lots of information floating around. You're going to come in contact with all kinds of stuff that you're going to, is going to be partial information. Rather than you make up a fantasy or story or get your facts wrong from some other source, will you talk to me about it? She does. She does. That gives me the assurance I need that very unlikely that something will happen to my kid.
That's great.
I don't, yeah. But not helicopter parenting is what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, yeah, no, and they're smart. I'm sure I will come to you with various things, various pieces of advice needed as we move along now. Of course, since we first did our interview, a lot has changed in my life on both aspects, you know.
Oh my God, we have something in common right this moment.
What's that?
You're waiting to see if you're pregnant and I'm waiting to see if I'm pregnant. We're sitting in a room together, both sometime in the next few days, we will know.
Yeah.
If we got babies on the way.
Right. Exciting times. Yeah.
It's so exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of cool, right?
The hot seat. We're both on the hot seat.
Yeah.
On our edges.
I mean, let's start with your story because it sort of came out of nowhere pretty much, did it or not? I mean, you know, in terms of being a parenting partner for this what would be the third time, you went through a series of perspectives, me being one of them, and...
Oh, I know, I practically begged you and you turned me down multiple times. It's incredibly humiliating, but I also endorse you because I'm not an asshole.
But, I mean, we had the discussion. I remember sort of you calling me up one day and sort of just saying, why did this not work out? Why are we not having kids? And me sort of trying to explain that we never figured out the details. The way I saw it was I was waiting to discuss all the details. Where would we live? How would we pay for things? All these sort of things to say, okay, let's move forward. You were waiting for me to say, okay, let's move forward to discuss all of those things. So we never met halfway because we were looking at it from a different perspective. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think because in my experience, all those details that you negotiate are out the door without commitment and intention.
But how can you make that commitment and intention without knowing those details beforehand?
You decide that you really, really trust and admire this person well enough to give a go at negotiating the details. Yeah, that, you know, you say, you know, I want to do this with you, and barring some major red flag on our negotiations, I'm moving forward with you. But there's no need to negotiate details when you don't have like a buy-in. And the buy-in trumps all details because those details are going to be renegotiated. They can't be the reason you do it. I did that. I made a huge mistake. The details are the division of finances was paramount to one of the decisions that I made to have this child with this parenting partner.
Right.
That blew the entire basis of the parenting partner gone. And what was I left with? A person who I don't particularly admire, I appreciate, who I don't particularly respect or trust, who I value, but not someone that I am real compatible with to raise a child with. And I made a huge mistake. I would dearly love other people to gain from my mistake. I would love that what I paid for and my child paid for and he paid for, that other people get that benefit.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
So that's why I talk about it. I'm not throwing myself under the bus or saying that I'm an ignorant piece of shit. I'm just saying that's why I take a strong stand on merit, character, keeping your agreements, being the type of person fundamentally who you feel you can raise a child with, because it's all about imparting your core values to a child. Right. You want to have a child with someone where you know that child's going to look at that other parent and go, that's my dad. Yes. Mm. Or that's my mom. If you don't know that, don't fucking have a kid with them, no matter how many details work. That's my message to the populace.
Right.
That's my PSA right there.
Yeah.
No matter how you're doing it, romantic or otherwise, don't have kids with people that you know, it doesn't matter how good you look on paper. It's who they are fundamentally.
Hmm. But even that can change as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How much do people's core values change, let's say, after 35? Very little.
Well, you did also just say that there are a lot of people when they're 40 have a midlife crisis and change dramatically.
That's true. A lot of people do, but a very minor percentage, maybe 10-25% at the most, if you want to call it that.
Mm.
So hedging your bets, I just chose to choose people over 40. I went a little bit over the mark into 60, 70. But I had other factors that influenced me. I found a strong peer alliance with the baby boomer age group because I didn't go to high school. I was a prodigy. I went to corporate America in my teens and I ego identified and belonged to the generation of the baby boomers. So I felt a kinship and a sense of belongingness that most people feel in high school with their peers. That's my peer group. So that was another factor in the blinders that I had on the fine pin. But yeah, I think people who are late 30s, early 40s are fairly stable in their minds and are not likely to have a nervous breakdown more than what would just be a major renegotiation of their sense of importance when they have a child. I mean, when you got a little wiggly baby who's totally dependent on you, all of a sudden you're not the center of the universe anymore.
Yeah, no, for sure.
That's a shocker for most people who got to 40 years old and they've been thinking, they don't even know they do it. It's like explaining water to a fish. It's constant. Everything is about me. Me, 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 me. Mm. All of a sudden, you get this little wiggly person, this slimy little person who's just a helpless, gurgling thing, and everything is about them. It's such a shocker.
Right.
Right. So character. You want somebody coming off the rails. Somebody's pretty solid in their character and their values and their merit is not going to freak out and have a nervous breakdown when they stop being a narcissist. They're going to feel freed. I did. I felt freaking free of my own bullshit that just I ran like a monkey in my head. All of a sudden, it just was like the clouds parted and I got to invest and send forth a person with all my love and all my resources and all my time and my energy and my values and send them forth greater and healthier into the world. My every move meant more. Not just to serve my own joy in life or my own gratification, but to do something, leave something, you know, something with hope and life.
Isn't she incredible? Plenty to sink your teeth into. We'll have more with her next week, including how a guy's situation in the world today is so unlike our natural instinct from how we evolved.
You're living in a society that has completely embraced paternal certainty. That's not how we evolved for millions of years. So we have part of us that would have gladly shared the responsibility of all babies born in the village with other men and women, and it's not squarely on your shoulders. We live in a very experimental society that is trying really hard to overcome our basic human animal nature and say, no, you man will be fully and solely responsible for this woman and this helpless child. And there will be no other men who will even think for a second that it's their child and invest at all. And you're on your own, buddy. Good luck.
I'll see you next week. Fucking hell. Well, that is it. Another week on this earth, another blessing. Thank you for listening and being part of my journey. Drop me a line if you have a comment or question, or if you think you know someone who'd be a good parenting partner for me. If you like the show, help spread the word, write a review, subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher so you don't miss an episode. I will be back next week, but until then, wherever you are and whoever you're with, be kind and happy. Let love rule. Hello.